Welcome to this session of Sunstone. This is session number 364, Women Making America, Finding Ourselves in Women's History. I'm glad to welcome you today. And first of all, let me ask you to all silence your cell phones and anything else so that won't distract from the session today. And just a brief mention is also that the books are for sale from Julie Savage today. And they're actually on discount, and she's willing to sign them afterwards. You can either talk to her or the woman in the back in the green shirt. She can help you out with it as well. So to introduce Julie Heming Savage, Julie Savage holds a bachelor's degree in history, English, and education, and a master's degree in American studies from Brigham Young University. She has taught junior high school, English, history, women's studies, and gifted education. She and her sister, Heidi Heming, recently authored Women Making America, which traces U.S. women's history from the Revolutionary War to the present in an engaging, accessible format. She lives in Silver Spring, Maryland, with her husband, Carl, and three kids. Thank you.
Good pals who have come to be supportive today. Okay, you just keep giving me that sign if you can't hear. So I hope that all of you will come away having learned something new today and something that will go on and energize you and bring you some new ideas for your life and for your futures. But I'd like to begin with a question. Do you remember when you first discovered a personal connection to history? An aha moment about yourself when you felt connected to someone from the past? If you do, do you remember what it was about that spoke to you? I distinctly remember in 1991, Laurel Ulrich came to BYU to speak, and I just followed her around, and I heard every word she said, and she signed my book, of a Midwife's Tale for Julie Heming, spread the word to a new generation of students. And she caught my imagination, and her book changed my idea of history forever. One of my first aha moments came during an undergraduate Mormon history class taught by James Allen at BYU. For the first time, I felt a real solid connection to history. These were my people, and I cared about it, and I cared about the stories, and I felt invested in understanding the history of these people. But it wasn't until I was a graduate student in American Studies at BYU that I took my first class in women's history, and it was a class taught by Carol Mattson, and I was completely smitten. I was thrilled by the stories. I couldn't get enough, but I also remember my sadness at realizing how long it had taken me to find out that women were more than footnotes in history. And so during this program, I devoured all of the books of women's history that I could. And there's just this rich, beautiful body of history that's been produced over the last 30 years. Then later, we moved to Kansas, and I was a junior high school teacher, and I was stunned by how little of that beautiful research had reached anyone in the secondary schools, or my neighbors, or anyone around me. There was this secret world of women's history going on that wasn't reaching anyone, and I found that really sad. One night, as I was trying to get ready to teach my junior high school women's studies class that I had made up, I was really frustrated by my inability to find materials to use with my students. And I went to bed, and I couldn't sleep, and I got up, and I had one of those spectacular experiences that you never forget, where God intervenes in your life. And God told me that I should write the book. And I said, I don't want to write the book. He said, write the book. I don't want to write the book. And so I went, and I, over the next few years, I grabbed my sister Heidi, and we started working on this book. And then it's a big project. The book languished, and we weren't working on it. And so God intervened again, and God got in touch with my dad one night, and he called me the next morning, and he said, "It's time for you girls to do the book again. I'm going to help you make it happen." And so we started working on the book, and it's taken 6 years, and here's our baby. It's a long-birthed baby. What we wanted to do in writing this book was to write a book of accessible history that wasn't just about the superstars of women's history, that was more about what women were actually doing through all these different periods of time, and a way to draw people in an accessible way. And so we covered the themes of women at home, paid work, health, education, women in the arts, beauty, and amusements. And so we're in the midst of writing this book, and I'm just immersed in this world of women's history, and I sometimes forget that now that there were men in history. And so it's particularly stunning to me to go to a place where there are no women. And I had that experience when I visited the U.S. Capitol a few years ago. And I made this trip to the Capitol building. You know, it's a shrine to the building of America, right? And I just felt kicked in the gut. Because as I walked through this Capitol building, I realized that these men thought that they had made America all by themselves. That they had begat themselves, they had fed themselves, they had just done it all by themselves. And it resembled everything that I'd learned in school. And I wasn't there. I could not find myself in the U.S. Capitol building. And so let me see if my technology works for me. Oh, I've got to get it to the right spot. See if we can make this work. Whoa, it's not up there anymore. Come on. Oh, I think it's going to just turn off. Oh, I want to show you Statuary Hall. Would you mind keeping working on going? Okay. Okay, so I have this lovely picture of Statuary Hall, and what you need to imagine is a bunch of statues of white guys. And so in Statuary Hall, there are 100 statues. Each state gets to choose two heroes from their state to represent them. And out of these 100 statues, only 7 of them are women. And recently, with a newly reconstructed visitor center, they've moved 5 of those into the visitor center. So when you go, women are still underrepresented, but it looks like there were some women in history. It's just when you get back into the Capitol that now there are like virtually no women. Back in the Capitol. So today, I would like to think about what the Capitol would look like if it more accurately represented the making of America. In thinking about where each of us is in the knowledge of women in history, I'd like to take a few minutes for everybody to grab out a pen, and I'm going to give you 3 minutes, and I want everybody to try and think of any women that they know in American history. And I would like you to think about, like, if you were doing a Capitol building and you could have statues of women, who are those women going to be? And I would say that since women make up 51% of the population, maybe we should get 51 statues. So see if you can come up with your good list of 51 women from American history, and the person who comes up with the most gets to take a book home today. So I'm going to start timing. You've got 3 minutes. Do your best women listing. Okay, they fit my head. Okay, Fanny. Thank you.
going to shut down right or something.
To share.
How are we doing? Anybody need any more time? Okay, so this is the moment, the one moment before we get to questions for a little bit of discussion. So how easy or hard was that? That's just a question that you want to just think about. Was it difficult to come up with a list, or was it easy? So let's start with how many people came up with five women? Raise your hands. You got five women. Who has 10 women? Oh, that's good. Who has 15 women? Anybody with 15? Oh, yes. Okay. 16? 17, 18, 19, 20, 25? 25! You are the happy winner!
I don't know whether this is fair or not. I said all 51 is the president's wives.
Oh! I should have said of their own merit, correct?
I couldn't have done with the president.
Wow! Do you feel good about winning the book?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so who didn't, the next runner-up, can I have you, since it won't be the list of that, can I have you stand up and share your list of names?
Well, I've got others than that.
Oh, okay.
Have her come up to the mic, too.
Would you come up to the mic?
Okay.
And aside from the wives, would you read us your list, and then do you want to come down and stand next to mine?
Okay. If she's the winner, she can read
it. Yeah, she's going to read the ones that aren't president's wives.
Oh. Well, the problem was I did some of the wives, and then anyway.
Okay.
So Jacqueline Kennedy, Harriet Truman, Abigail Adams, Helen Keller, Mrs. FDR Roosevelt.
Oh,
I can't remember her first name. Oh. Sorry,
you're killing me. I named my daughter after her. It's Eleanor.
Eleanor. Okay.
Okay.
Nancy Reagan, Condoleezza Rice, Betty Ford, died in the Challenger. I can't remember her.
Okay. All right. Keep it up. Keep going.
Amelia Earhart, Betsy Ross, Emma Smith, and then the rest. But
right.
I could go on for Elias.
Okay. Oh, that's good. Okay, that's good. We'll talk about that. Do you want to come up and let's hear your list? Maybe we'll have everybody vote.
I had some similar, of course, some of the same. Yeah. Okay, I had Susan B. Anthony, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Elizabeth Blackwell, Martha Washington, Abigail Adams, Dolly Madison, Sacagawea, Pocahontas, Hillary Clinton, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sandra Day O'Connor, Geraldine Ferraro, Ethel Kennedy, Eunice Shriver, Sojourner Truth, Krista McAuliffe, Madeleine Albright, Jackie Kennedy, Mary Lincoln, Betsy Ross. I added Virginia Woolf and I added Squeaky Fromm, who just got out of prison for trying to assassinate a president.
Wow, very good. Okay, so for those of you who had an easy time, I would like to challenge you to just go forth and do your best to help sponsor a world where women aren't left out. For those of you that had a hard time, I'd like to challenge you to challenge yourselves to know your women's history, to learn what you're missing in your life. So I'd like to talk a little bit about my own nominations. Some are very obvious choices. I would say people like Eleanor Roosevelt, Ida B. Wells, who is ran an anti-lynching campaign, Harriet Tubman, Mary Cassatt, the painter, Rachel Carson, Rosa Parks, everyone knows Rosa Parks, and one of my nominations, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, actually has a spot in the Capitol. In the rotunda, there's a statue of some suffrage women. But I have to say that I love Elizabeth Cady Stanton so much
that I think she needs her own, like, looming statue over everyone else. I think she deserves a place, like her own room, because she's fabulous. And since she's my favorite, even though we all know probably some of the outlines of her life, that she was a crusader for women's rights, she's known for her suffrage work. Even though we know those things, I would like to share just a few anecdotes from her life that will maybe bring her to life a little bit, just because she is so totally delightful. This is Elizabeth Cady Stanton with her two oldest sons. And I don't know why we don't always use this picture of her rather than the little old lady picture, because that is an engaging, fun woman. And the other pictures don't capture her lively spirit, I think. So that's actually one of the things that we tried to do in the book, is try and choose pictures that made you go, oh, right on. She's somebody I'd like to know. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was so radical in her time that her visions of women's potential, many of those have yet even to be accomplished. And so I think she's fabulous. But that didn't make her many friends during her life. One young woman from Seneca Falls refused to ride in the same carriage with her, saying, I wouldn't have been seen with her for anything with those ideas of hers. But Stanton would have dismissed this woman with one of her very core beliefs, which was, it is a settled maxim with me that the existing public sentiment on any subject is wrong. Let's see, did that work? Nope, we gotta go again. Okay. For a portion of her life, Elizabeth Cady Stanton joined in the protest against, quote unquote, the women's clothes prison. When she was 8 months pregnant, her cousin Elizabeth Smith Miller visited her in a fine outfit like this. And she wrote, this dress makes it easier to do all these things, running from cradle to writing desk, from kitchen to drawing room, singing lullabies at one moment in the nursery, and dear old Tom Moore ditties the next moment on the piano. If I had long skirts, how could I accomplish all this? The New York Herald predicted women in bloomers would soon, quote unquote, end their career in the lunatic asylum or perchance in the state prison for wearing this outfit. And the thing that I find endearing about this story is that Elizabeth Cady Stanton's own sons begged her not to wear this outfit to visit them in college. So that can resonate with some of us. But so within a few years, even the most stalwart wearers of this outfit had to give up their outfits. And Lucy Stone, another of my favorite suffragists, said, we could go upstairs without stepping on ourselves and go downstairs without being stepped on, but useful as the bloomer was, the ridicule of the world killed it. So you just feel sad for these women just going back, because you've seen the later pictures, the styles have got even worse. They're up their necks and they look, it just is not comfortable. Another favorite, this is my last Elizabeth Cady Stanton anecdote, but during a lecture in Nebraska, an angry man rudely interrupted Elizabeth Cady Stanton one day. He said, don't you think that the best thing a woman can do is perform well her part in the role of wife and mother? My wife has presented me with 8 beautiful children. Is not hers a better life work than that of exercising the right of suffrage? Looking him up and down, she responded, frankly, sir, I know a few men worth repeating 8 times. I love that. So, she deserves her own very large space in the Capitol, I think. But I'd like to also share with you some less-known women, some people that maybe you didn't mention, although I was pretty impressed that Elizabeth Blackwell was on your list. We'll be talking about her today. My favorite women are often the activists, and they're the women who just see something that needs to be done, and they just take it on. And one of those women is Mother Jones. You might have heard the magazine named after Mother Jones. She was a little old lady. She was best known for her battle cry that said, pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living. And her story is really touching because she was well past 70. She was barely 5 feet tall. She weighed less than 100 pounds, but she was absolutely fearless. She watched her husband and her 4 children die, one by one, in a yellow fever epidemic in 1867. She went on. She started a dressmaking business in Chicago. And that burned to the ground in the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. So within those 4 years, she lost her entire family. She lost her business. What is there to live for? And so if anyone had a good excuse for just throwing in the towel and saying, I'm done, I'm giving up on life, it was Mother Jones, but she didn't. She instead devoted the remainder of her life to improving the lives of mine and factory workers. So as many of you know, conditions in coal and copper mining areas of Appalachia and Colorado and Arizona were really bleak. Workers and their families risked their lives daily for exhausting, unhealthy, low-paying jobs. In order to survive, mothers were sending their kids to work at as early an age as 6 or 7 years old. And many of those kids, many of those people died or were permanently disabled by their accidents. Miners' wives lived a really bleak life of unceasing battle with grime, poverty, illness, and premature death. But Mother Jones, this little old lady, was their ally. One thing that's not in the book that we couldn't fit in, but she led an entire march of child laborers for miles and miles and miles to go to Teddy Roosevelt's summer home to protest child labor, to try and get child labor laws. But she believed that no strike was ever won that didn't have the support of women. After one seemingly hopeless strike in Pennsylvania, she told the men to stay home with their children. She then created an army of miners' wives, wielding mops, brooms, and washtubs, and marched them to the entrance of the mine. They basically knocked over the guard, scared the mules, chased strikebreakers, and created total pandemonium. They stood guard over the mine for a number of days and nights, and the strike was a success. She repeatedly put herself in real danger and in the center of these labor conflicts. When she was 74 years old, she was thrown out of Colorado for helping with a strike. She dashed off this letter to the governor, and if any of you can read it, it's in the yellow right there. This is 1904. Governor James H. Peabody. Mr. Governor, you notified your dogs of war to put me out of the state. They complied with your instructions. I hold in my hand a letter that was handed to me by one of them, which says, under no circumstances return to this state. I wish to notify you, Governor, that you don't own the state. I am right here in the Capitol after being out 9 or 10 hours, 4 or 5 blocks from your office. I want to ask you, Governor, what in hell are you going to do about it? My 7-year-old discovered this story in the book, and she was just so hurt that I had the word hell in the book. She just came to me, and she was like, well, Mom, did you say it? I said, she said it. I didn't say it. But undaunted, Mother Jones led workers until she was nearly 100 years old. And she's actually buried near my house, which is great. Okay, you want to change again? And what would we do without the lovely Gorilla Girls? Does anybody know about the Gorilla Girls? Right here? Yeah, you won. Everyone should know about the Gorilla Girls. Of this next group of women, Heather Sokos of the Lexington Herald Leader said, quote, sometimes battling sexism in the normal way just won't do. Sometimes you must don a gorilla mask, adopt the name of a dead female artist, and send estrogen pills to the White House. So in 1985, the start of the Gorilla Girls, the Museum of Modern Art in New York City put on a show that featured the brightest stars in contemporary art. One critic said, if you're not in this show, you're nobody. Of the exhibited 169 artists, only 13 were women, and none were people of color. So some women protested in the normal ways, but this other group of women got together and placed these posters all over New York City. And so this is how the group of the Gorilla Girls began. Since 1985, the Gorilla Girls have dubbed themselves the conscience of culture. And they produce posters, stickers, books, billboards, stage protests. They have a great website if you want to read about them, with a really engaging, hilarious interview. When on a mission, each Gorilla Girl dons her mask, and she assumes the name of a dead female artist in order to remain anonymous. A couple of fun quotes from them. Our situation as women and artists of color in the art world was so pathetic. All we could do was make fun of it. It felt so good to ridicule and belittle a system that excluded us. When asked how they could stand wearing those masks all day, Emily Carr responded, "It's hot," to which another member added, "Not as hot as we make it out there." And Alma Thomas concluded, "But we look so beautiful, it's hard to complain." In more recent years, the Grill Girls have actually been asked to speak at some of the very institutions that they've attacked. By jumping into the fray, they've joined the myriads of women, past and present, who've worked to give women an equitable and a respected place at the American table. And now we come to Margaret Sanger. How can we have a hall without Margaret Sanger? I would have a shrine to Margaret Sanger in my house if I could. And though her statue would probably cause a political brouhaha, even now, she should be in there, because there's not a person alive in America, I would say, whose life has not been impacted by Margaret Sanger. And I can guarantee that most Americans have absolutely no idea who she is. At the turn of the last century, many American women had very incomplete knowledge about how to prevent pregnancy. This was due in large measure to legislation passed by Congress in 1873. It was called the Comstock Law. And what it did is that it labeled all information about contraception obscene. It was in the same category as pornography. And so the consequences of that were far-reaching. It made selling contraception illegal, and doctors were not even allowed to give out any information about birth control to their patients, whether they had 3 children or 15 children. And so with little or no information about birth control, women had little choice but to just keep having baby after baby after baby. Margaret Sanger was a nurse and later an activist who was almost alone in her fight for women's right to birth control. Margaret Sanger believed that until women could control what happened to their own bodies, other changes for women, like gaining the vote, which was the big move right at that time, would have little meaning. She preached, quote-unquote, joyous voluntary motherhood and coined the phrase, every child a wanted child. Personally witnessing the desperate conditions of women, she wrote, "These were not merely unfortunate conditions among the poor, such as we read about. I knew the women personally. They were living, breathing human beings with hopes, fears, and aspirations like my own. Yet their weary, misshapen bodies were destined to be thrown on the scrap heap before they were 35. One night, after watching a young Russian immigrant named Sadie Sachs die from complications of a botched abortion, it's the most tragic story. Margaret Sanger walked the streets all night long, and she said that she reflected on the pains and griefs of those women. She recalled, it was the dawn of a new day in my life also. I was resolved to seek out the root of evil, to do something to change the destiny of mothers whose miseries were as vast as the sky." So Margaret Sanger decided to reach out to the other progressives. They're just progressive. Women are out there just changing the world in 100 million ways right around the turn of the century. She turned to Carrie Chapman Catt, Jane Addams, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, and others engaged in this feminist struggle of the period, and none of them appreciated her vision. She remembered her frustrations. How were mothers to be saved? Progressive women whom I consulted were thoroughly discouraging. "Wait until we get the vote, then we'll take care of it," they assured me. "Wait until women have more in education. Wait until we share secure equal distribution of wealth. Wait for this, wait for that, wait, wait, wait." But Sanger was not willing to wait, so she just went off on her own and did what she could. In 1913, she published information about women's bodies and sexually transmitted diseases and was threatened with arrest. Instead, she traveled to Europe to get away. She founded the National Birth Control League. She published The Women Rebels. She came back to the United States, and she was arrested and indicted. But she succeeded in eluding arrest by going to Europe again. When she came back to America in 1916, she and her sister Ethel opened a clinic for working-class women in Brooklyn. And during the 10 days the clinic was open, over 500 women came to her for information about birth control. And then she was arrested. She was jailed for 30 days, But that didn't stop her. She just kept battling. She battled in the courts and did everything she could, but it wasn't until 1936 that the Comstock Law Act was struck down and doctors were able to prescribe contraception for their patients. She then traveled internationally, fighting for women's rights to know about birth control and for birth control research. In 1960, the birth control pill went on the market, and by the time of Sanger's death 6 years later, millions of American women were using this revolutionary form of contraception. Writing of her life's work, Sanger concluded, "My life has been joyous and exulting and full because it has touched profoundly millions of other lives. It is ever a privilege to be a part of something unquestionably proved of value, something so fundamentally right." And if you think about your own lives, where would we be without Margaret Sanger? She's changed the world, and for her to not be acknowledged is really a travesty. Okay, the next one. I would definitely include one of my favorite women, and she's one that I'm sure that probably nobody has heard of in here, unless they've read the book. Elizabeth Murray was way ahead of her time. She was orphaned and brought over from Scotland by her brother, and he set her up with a shop in Boston selling imported goods. She married and was widowed, and then she married again, and she was widowed again, but this time she inherited a vast amount of wealth. On September 26, 1771, Elizabeth Murray Campbell Smith chose to marry for a third time. But this time it was a little bit different. Unwilling to give up her hard-won financial and legal independence, if you remember, this is the period where women had no rights. They couldn't own their own wages, they couldn't write their own wills, they couldn't, if they left the marriage, they didn't take the children with them, though that was mainly like desertion. But when she married again, she had her third husband, Ralph Inman, sign a 6-page prenuptial agreement that gave her continued control over her considerable estate. She wrote to her brother, "By contract, he has put in my power to will away everything as if I was not married." And this turned out to be a really wise move because it was not that happy of a union. And when she died, she willed him a little bit of stuff, and the rest she willed to the women in her life. A few to some other people, but mainly to four nieces, Dolly, Betsy, Polly, and Anne, for, quote-unquote, their own personal use and disposal. And so for Murray, this final statement was in line with her whole life's work, because what she did is that she spent this considerable wealth that she had to help women in her life get set up for independence. So she set up girls and nieces with shops so that they could be independent. And she called it her extensive and benevolent plan of usefulness. And when one of her nieces went back to England to be with her family, Polly assured her aunt, "The spirit of independence that you cherished in me is not yet extinct." And so I just love these women that were sort of outside of their time and were able to see what the world could be. What time are we done? 8:30. Okay. And so also, how about the intrepid women, the first? Anne Taylor, you may not know, was the first person to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel, and she was a woman, in 1901. And though she was bruised and bleeding, she survived to say, quote unquote, "Nobody ought ever to do that again." I think we'll all take her advice. Up in the left-hand corner over here is 20-year-old Gertrude Ederle, that in 1926 became the first woman to swim the English Channel. You'll see she sported goggles, a swim cap, and one of the first two-piece swimsuits ever worn in public. You see she's kind of covered with stuff. She slathered head to toe in lanolin, and she battled rain, high waves, shifting tides, and seasickness as she swam. She sang songs to keep herself going, like "Let Me Call You Sweetheart," and "Yes, We Have No Bananas." And she swam from 7:09 a.m. until 9:40 p.m., becoming the first woman to cross the channel and beating preceding swimmers. There were five men who'd swum before her by 2 hours. And one reporter called it the greatest athletic feat by a woman in the history of the world. And they threw her a huge ticker tape parade. Another first that we heard about. Anybody else have Elizabeth Blackwell on their list? Anybody get it? Oh, okay. Elizabeth Blackwell became the first woman doctor in America. In 1847, she applied to multiple programs and was rejected by every single one. When Geneva Medical College admitted her finally, she had no idea that it had been a joke on the part of the student body. The moment the dean announced, quote unquote, in a trembling voice that the female student had arrived, a hush fell upon the class as if each member had been stricken with paralysis. A death-like stillness prevailed during the lecture, and only the newly arrived student took notes. She graduated the top of her class at age 27, but her success didn't do anything to pave the way for her sister Emily, who wanted to go to medical school as well. Geneva College wouldn't admit her, and it took her sister Emily 6 years to get admitted to any medical program. But she and her sister Emily got busy. They practiced in New York. When her attempts met with resistance, she opened a clinic for poor women and children on the east side of New York. And she opened the New York Infirmary for Indigent Women and Children that was run entirely by women. And so she's somebody that we should know about. So her picture's up there on the left-hand side. She has some pictures of her a little later looking a little more severe. Okay, the next one. There are great characters in women's history, and one of my favorites is this woman, Mary Fields. She was tall, strong, gun-toting, cigar-smoking ex-slave protector of nuns who became known as Stagecoach Mary for delivering mail through all kinds of Montana weather at the age of 60. And there's just great stories about her. Later on, she lived in this town, and she loved baseball. And so any guy who made a home run, she would bring flowers from her garden and put them in his boutonniere, or like in his buttonhole. So Mary Fields, just an awesome woman if you learn her story. I love, one of the things I love about women's history is that I just love that each of these women found their thing. That Elizabeth Blackwell was just trying to be Elizabeth Blackwell. The world already had an Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She didn't need to be her. She needed to be who she was. Gertrude Ederle was not beating herself that she wasn't going to medical school. She's just swimming the English Channel. And so I think one of the things I find really inspiring is these women are just finding the thing that speaks to them and finding their way to make the world a better place. So I just love these women. And I love their stories. But where does that lead us? What impact can these kinds of stories have on our individual lives? I feel like this history has the power to draw us in and make us feel like active participants in the making of history. It says to me that the choices we make really matter. And I would submit to you that a more inclusive history makes for better people. And so we need to turn our attention not only to the individual leaders of the movements, but to the ordinary women who made their impact in smaller ways that together have made an enormous difference. What of those who made a tremendous contribution by raising their kids? And so we have the story of my grandmother building a cabin to live in during the Depression. And we have this picture of my dear mother, who is sitting right there, who gave everything she had to raising 4 kids. Do you want to stand up, Mom? She's cute as a button. And having kids of my own, I have 3 kids of my own, and hating to do laundry myself, we honored my mother by, and all the women who spent a good portion of their lives doing laundry by having a picture of my mom holding tons of laundry. What about the moms that have seen their children through sickness and poverty and war and just the everyday processes of keeping kids alive, clothed, fed, and happy I just love this picture. Go to the next one. There are lots of great mom pictures in this. I just love this picture of this woman. It's Civil War, and there's no story behind it that has been preserved, but is she visiting her husband? Is she a camp follower? But look at these kids. She's just a mom trying to make it in the world, and women's history is just full of these great moments where you, if you are yourself mothering, you can see yourself. Pearl Buck, the famous author, said that she did everything that she did around all of the domesticity of her life. And if she had a husband, or if she'd been a man, that she would have had secretaries taking care of all sorts of things for her. But as it was, she did it around her children. Harriet Beecher Stowe, there's just example of example after example of women who were making the world a better place around mothering. Okay, which mom can't identify with a Pittsburgh housewife that complained in 1965, "I feel like a pie cut up in 6 pieces being served to a dinner party of 10. Anybody feeling it? All of the movements have needed visionary leaders, but they wouldn't have gotten far without the vast numbers of women and men who have supported these movements and done great work. They're the women who joined the club movement in the last turn of the century, like the turn of the 19th century. And these lovely corseted crusaders just went out into the world to make the world a better place. They started school lunch programs and improved conditions in hospitals and prisons and mental institutions. They opened homes for the elderly and for wayward youth. They struck out at social problems such as poverty, illiteracy, and alcoholism. And in them, we see the power of grassroots organizing. It's really a powerful story. I love the suffrage and women's rights movements. The suffrage movement is just like eating candy to me to learn about it. It's just full of energizing and inspiring stories. And same thing with the 1970s women's rights movement. In the 1970s, a newly converted feminist took action to change her university's health policy toward rape victims. She remembers that she was, quote, petrified. "Would someone yell at me? Would I get thrown out of school? My heart was always pounding. I almost never felt I knew enough or was smart enough to be confident. But we acted in spite of not knowing enough, being smart enough, or being confident enough. And the policy changed. We learned that if you act, you can change the world." So these are my club movement women, and then keep going. There's our abolitionists, and keep on going. And I love this, "Don't call me girl." This little yellow sidebar is about a woman and her friends going in to stake out one of their husbands that was working for Penthouse magazine and making him quit. That part is just littered with great stories. I could go on about them forever. There are the women that joined the abolitionist movement. There's the story of a woman sitting at the back of her church, clicking her knitting needles loudly to protest her pro-slavery preacher. Just, you know? And so here's just this one woman, but she was just back there making her own little difference with her knitting needles. And I love that story. We don't have to be the leaders of the movement. We can be the clicking the needles lady. The civil rights movement is just full of awesome women. We all know about Rosa Parks, but Rosa Parks didn't do the civil rights movement all by herself. There were myriads of women just in there fighting the fight. One woman, Eunita Blackwell, a sharecropper in the Mississippi Delta, vividly recalled the day that civil rights workers came to town. Workers stood up at church and talked about voting as the right of every individual. When they asked for volunteers to venture to the town hall and register to vote, Blackwell stood up. She recalled, "My husband caught me by the dress tail and pulled me back down because he was supposed to stand up first, you see, because he's the man. So he stood up, then I stood up, and I've been standing ever since." That's inspiring stuff, I think. So back to our Capitol building. our new improved Capitol building that we're creating in our minds. Let's have women represented. Let's have women, the statue of the woman clicking her knitting needles. Let's have a church lady from the civil rights movement. Let's pay tribute to the men and women who've made an impact by adding their voices to those seeking justice. And let's honor the moms and their cumulative sacrifice for the making of America. So I want you to imagine just walking through this Capitol building inhabited by these women and more. And as a side note, I'd like you to imagine what our hall would look like if it were filled with our Mormon women. Who would we have in that hall? Surrounded, just imagine ourselves being surrounded by these people with great vision. Okay, next slide. On April 28th of this year, the hard work of a small group of women culminated in the unveiling of a statue of Sojourner Truth in the Capitol's Emancipation Hall. Sojourner Truth, as many of you know, was a valiant abolitionist and former slave. At the ceremony, Hillary Clinton said these words, "Was any person ever better named?" And actually, she named herself. She came up with that name. But think about it. She is a sojourner of truth, by truth, and for truth. And her words, her example, and her legacy will never perish from this earth so long as men and women stand up and say loudly and clearly, "We hear you echoing down through the years of history. We believe that your journey is not yet over, and we will make the rest of that journey with you." God bless the memory of Sojourner Truth. And I would add, God bless the memory of all good men and women from our past. May we use them to remind us of the importance of our lives and the gifts that we have to share with the world. And I'd like to end with just a little montage here.
Questions, you can come up to the mic and say them.
And my mom requested to have you face that way so she can never hear the questions.
As a retired history teacher, I'm very intrigued by this presentation. When I started teaching history back in the early 1970s, it was kind of in the middle of the women's rights movement, and we were just becoming increasingly, sensitive to the, the absence or the lacuna of women in history, and so I'm very sympathetic to, that you're bringing this to younger generation. I assume this book is kind of designed for younger...
Designed for anybody who wants.
Anybody, well...
but yes, for younger, too.
I missed the introduction. I assume you're a teacher.
I am. Right? Yeah.
And so I was going to say, I want to kind of relate this to the Mormon aspects. Two questions. Number one, having been brought up Latter-day Saint, attend BYU and where you got your education, how did your increased consciousness of the role, the absence and discovering the significant role of women in the larger American society, how did that modify and affect your perceptions of the place of women within Mormonism? And then as a follow-up, what you would suggest in your presentation, if you were asked to make up a Hall of Fame of notable Mormon women, what who would be the top five or more Latter-day Saint women would you include in your Hall of Fame or statutory hall?
Oh, okay. Well, I think my husband was actually a feminist before I was a feminist. He was a women's studies minor at BYU, and everyone should marry a women's studies minor, I think. But so it is really made me reach out more to women, to my Mormon feminist community. I love going to Exponent retreats and reading Exponent, and I've been a bit on the Mormon feminist. I've been a lurker at the Mormon Feminist Housewives, so it's really made me want to reach out. One little story, I went to a history conference, and I came out as a Mormon on the first day, and women throughout the conference just came to me secretly throughout the conference just saying, "Now, are you a practicing Mormon? Like, is that possible?" And at the very end, the head of the conference came up to me and thanked me. She said, I'd like to thank you for bearing witness of your Mormonism." I thought that was a really interesting choice. She said, because it helped me shatter my stereotypes about Mormon women. And so I like to put myself out there. I love being Mormon, and I love being a feminist, and I love having people know that I'm both of those things so that I can help people understand that they're not mutually exclusive. I was thinking about the list for who I would include. And they're just the superstars. There's Eliza R. Snow, Emmeline B. Wells. My mom was really sad. We have a Minerva Tykert painting, but we didn't really talk about Minerva Tykert. And so my mom is sad that we shafted Minerva Tykert in the book. And so I would include her. And then I was wondering, does Esther Peterson count as a Mormon? Because she was raised Mormon, she didn't practice through her life. But Esther Peterson is somebody that everyone should know about as well, and she began in a Mormon community. And so one of the historians of the church just was telling me, "You need to do this book for the Mormon women." And I said, "I'm done for now. That's going to be somebody else's
book." Would you include Emma Smith on there?
Oh, I would include Emma Smith. I just started thinking of this like half an hour ago. I started making my little list. Oh, that's interesting.
Martha Hughes family.
Okay. Anybody want to shout out somewhere? Juanita Brooks. She's a good one. See, my list is like I'd have to think about it for a while.
Sherry Dew is.
Sherry Dew is a
good one. She's so dichotomous, everybody kind of thinks.
Yeah.
She's not.
Okay, I think, is our time?
We have a few more minutes. We could probably have one more question.
I think there are more.
All right.
Thank you so much for coming. And would you please, if you do like the book, let your libraries in your home areas know about it, your teachers, your friends. Gotta get the word out.